Our next case for argument this morning is United States against Hewlett. Mr. Hunt.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Edward John Hunt. I represented Alfred Gary at the trial level in this case. If it pleases the court, I want to concentrate my arguments today on what I believe was the reversible error caused by the hastiness of the judge of sending in a supplemental instruction, and also concentrate on what I feel was reversible error when there was a fatal variance from the indictment and there were multiple conspiracies introduced at trial. I realize, Your Honors, that I did raise an issue challenging the enhancement of my client, Mr. Gary, to a life sentence. And I realize also that there's been much ink spilled after Almendez-Torres and the Shepard case. But I think really the thrust of the error here, let's begin towards the end of the trial. The jury sent back a question to the effect, can we find one defendant guilty and another defendant not guilty? Well, my initial response was a rather simple one. Just tell them yes. The government cited in its brief, and if I just may get it, Your Honor, the original.
Please don't talk.
I'm sorry.
While you're facing the wall.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Come back here and tell us what you need to say.
The government cited in its original brief that Judge Clavert initially instructed the jurors, I quote, even though the defendants are being tried together, you must give each of them separate consideration.
Can I just stop you?
Yes.
Because what I've been trying to figure out is how does a statement that a jury must consider the guilt of each defendant indicate that the jury should conclude that each defendant is in fact guilty?
Well, Judge, it seems to send back a confusion, a conflict in their original instruction. And if I just may read that original instruction that clarified, I think that the law seems to say quite clearly that simple is best. Don't confuse the jury. And the supplemental instruction, originally the judge was going to use the phrase innocence. I simply tried to clarify that in criminal trials, the question is guilty or not guilty. He became upset, Your Honor, and he is a good man, a good person, a good judge. I take no issue with him as a district court judge. I think it was late in the day. He became upset. He sent in this instruction, Judge, which seems to direct a verdict. Then later he corrects himself, as the court is aware from reading the briefs. He sends in an instruction after Ms. Pepper, who is representing.
How does this instruction direct a verdict? You're losing me.
Well, Judge, it only emphasized the word guilt. It didn't discuss guilt or not guilt, and that's why, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I don't have any quarrel with your argument that the best response here, my view, would have been for the judge to say, yes. You have a very simple question. The answer is yes. But what the judge did here, maybe it sure wasn't the best way to respond, in my view, but I don't know how that really confused the jury.
Judge, if you take a look at the history, they asked a question, can we convict one and find another not guilty, or words to that effect, he sends in that instruction. Then there's argument. Then
were the original instructions sent into the jury?
Pardon me?
The original instructions available in the jury room during deliberations.
Yes, the what I was just about to read, Your Honor.
All the instructions that the judge gave to the jury before it retired, were those instructions available in the jury room?
I'm fairly certain they were, Your
That's
Honor.
That's the usual practice.
Yes, the
so
usual
the
practice.
Judge have just said, refer to the instructions. The answer is there.
They were, and they also directed the jury. I mean, the statement also directed the jury to the instructions, which properly set forth the role of the jury.
Well, then you have the problem, Your Honor, that if you're going to send in an instruction, and that the instruction that was sent in originally was, even though defendants are being tried together, you must give each of them separate consideration. In doing this, you must analyze what the evidence shows about each defendant, leaving out of consideration any evidence that was admitted solely against the other defendant. Each defendant is entitled to have his case decided on the evidence and the law that applies to the defendant. By sending in this other instruction, and then, Your Honor, with all due respect, I got cut off. I was trying to make my point. I was trying to slow down this train. And I'm not saying this out of hubris, but as I took a look at the trial record, when they were talking about acquitting one and convicting another, I thought they were talking about my client, because if I took a look at the scope of all the evidence, my client was being mentioned less. And so I was fighting hard just to slow the judge down, but I was cut off, and that's where I believe the case is Rogers, the United States Supreme Court case, that says that counsel has a right to be heard to make his case. Yes, it's Rogers versus United States that is cited in my brief. Then, if I just may finish this point, Your Honor, then the judge sends in another instruction. And, Judge, I just think it created a mess, Your Honor. Go ahead. You had another question.
Well, I thought we should get, because you have so little time. Is it your argument that there's separate conspiracies here based mainly on the time span involved and the different geographical locations? I mean, is there any evidence that Gary or Hewlett weren't acting together to distribute narcotics in those locations?
Well, Judge, the problem here is, goes back procedurally. Mr. Hewlett moved to change the venue when, at the outset, all anyone was paying attention to was this Missouri traffic stop. That was the subject of a suppression hearing. Now, this Missouri traffic stop, it was introduced into evidence, and by the way, Your Honors, those drugs were the only drugs that were on the table. The government never connected Missouri to anything else in the case. Now, Your Honor, it's true that Gary and Hewlett's name were mentioned, but as to that traffic stop, there were a number of objections, motions for mistrial. Mr. Hewlett's motion for change of venue, the fatal variance and the prejudice that results from that fatal variance is that you have this Janesville experience that supposedly in the 1990s. Then there's a gap in time. Then there's this Racine experience in 1999 with Otters. Then there's, after that, there's this traffic stop on April 24th, 2003. Cassandra Maiden, who was a young lady in the car, is called.
Counsel, if you would just stand at the lectern.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I would appreciate it. Your comments are being recorded. Just stand in the middle of the lectern.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You have this Cassandra Maiden who the government has an opportunity to try and connect whatever relevance that has. Now, obviously, that has spillover prejudice to Gary and to Hewlett, but more importantly, both of them had a right to be tried and charged in a district, Missouri, where they had committed an offense. It's like the government just threw it in. To say the least, this was a trial just like any other trial, only more so, to paraphrase Casablanca. It was a strange trial in that sense. I remember in my closing argument, I made much ado about these drugs that had been laying out there that obviously prejudiced everyone. And it just seemed like there were multiple conspiracies, but there wasn't the nexus. They didn't tie the nexus between Racine and Janesville and Missouri. And they had an opportunity to do so, but it just didn't happen, Your Honors. I don't know where I'm at time. I'm a little colorblind, so...
Well, there's no light on, so...
There's no
light.
Oh, all right.
You've reserved 2 minutes, and you have more than 2 minutes to go.
Okay, thank you. You know, if you take a look at the dramatis personae in the Janesville adventure, you have Ozzie Hewlett, you have Gary. Lavelle Hewlett is mentioned, but he's never brought in.
The white light is now on.
All right.
So I have 2 minutes.
All right. I'll reserve it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Trimmer.
Then we have another.
Ms. Trimmer has 2 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Trimmer on behalf of Ozzie Hewlett. The only issue that I'm going to address today is the cross-appeal, which is the government has cross-appealed Mr. Hewlett's sentence.
Why don't you address the cross-appeal after it's been presented?
I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor.
That's a good idea. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Mr. Koenig.
May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Koenig. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear on behalf of the United States.
Can you describe the connection established to the jury between the Janesville sales and the Racine ones? I mean, there was a 2-year time gap between those activities, right?
Actually, no, Your Honor. I would encourage the panel to consult the testimony of DeAndre Mayfield, April Peters, and Patrick Otters. If you look at it carefully, I think you'll find that throughout this was a conspiracy that was based or headquartered in Racine. It eventually branched out to Janesville for reasons that Mr. Mayfield explained in his testimony. There was less interference from gangs and so forth. So there was an opportunity there. Janesville is about 60 miles away, I believe, from Racine. And Mr. Otters, in particular, testified to some activities of the conspiracy in 2000 and 2001. I will concede that he was in jail for some of that time, but it wasn't very long. And since we're on the variance question, I'd like to observe that I think it's easy to create an impression of multiple conspiracies by focusing on details such as, you know, which city was the focus of drug dealing at a particular point in time, who the customers were, or even what use the customers made of the cocaine. Much is made, for example, of the fact that Mr. Otters eventually learned to cook powder himself and turn it into crack and so forth. That doesn't change the fact that there was an ongoing conspiracy involving Hewlett and Gary. It always came back to those two individuals, and they were always doing the same thing, namely conspiring to distribute controlled substances. And even if there were multiple conspiracies, it seems to me the evidence showed, and counsel has conceded, that the defendants each participated in each sub-conspiracy, which leads to a consideration of prejudice. And under these circumstances, as this court held in United States v. Curtis, 37 F. 3rd 301, 1994, where the defendants are at the hub of various possible agreements, it's not even clear that a multiple conspiracy instruction is necessary. Of course, one was given in this case. And lastly, on the variance issue, I would point out that a variance claim, as this court well knows, fails in the absence of a showing of prejudice. And there's no discussion at all of prejudice in the defendant's opening brief. And I would suggest that under United States versus Aquila, 976 F. 2nd 1044, a 1992 case from this court, which is exactly on point, the issue of prejudice has been waived in its entirety, to say nothing of the last-minute attempt to revive a challenge to venue. The venue issue was litigated in the district court. The defendants lost. It was not part of their appeal until the reply brief. I had not intended to say much about the jury instruction issue, but since my colleague has discussed it at length, I would like to say briefly that the challenged instruction was to consider each defendant's guilt separately. And I'd like to suggest, as I did in my brief, that even if you consider that instruction in isolation, it's not problematic. Now, maybe a simpler response would have been better. In the calm reflection of this courtroom, we could say that. But you also have to keep in mind that considering each defendant's guilt separately implies that there's an alternative to guilt, okay, which is what the defense is trying to get at by inserting non-guilt. And then also, of course, this challenged instruction is bookended by the jury instruction that the defendants requested, which went in with the jury at the beginning of their deliberations, and an instruction that ultimately was given that was satisfactory to the defendants. And in addition, of course, there was a verdict form that called for separate entries as to each defendant. Under these circumstances, I think a simple or childlike jury instruction was not necessary, and the one that was given certainly is not a basis for overturning the verdicts. Now, I'm sorry, I'm procedurally a little bit confused because I've never done a cross appeal.
Perhaps it's time for you to turn to the cross appeal.
Yes, sir.
I have a couple of questions about this.
Yes, sir.
One,
Judge.
You have not relied, at least in your brief, on 28 U.S.C. 994H. Did you rely on it in the district court?
Refresh my memory, Your Honor, 994H
requires district judges to sentence armed career criminals at the top, at or near, it says, the top of the statutory maximum range. And we have held that 994H is not affected by Booker, which means, since the statutory maximum range in this case is life, that 994H required a sentence in this case at or near life imprisonment.
For Hewlett.
I would have thought that that was a slam dunk argument in this case. But your brief doesn't make it, and I was just wondering whether it was made in the district court. And I gather from the fact that you appear to be ignorant of the statute that it was not made in the district court. Why are we arguing here about number of levels of change when there's a statute which required the sentence to be at or near life?
You are correct. As far as I'm aware, the statute was not relied on below, and apparently I overlooked it in preparing the brief as well. And then obviously, if your analysis is correct, then the discussion in the brief is irrelevant, and what I'm about to say is irrelevant as well.
No. Everything in the brief remains relevant because arguments that have not been made either here or in the district court are forfeited. Similarly, the only reason that the district court appeared to have given for reducing this sentence is to avoid disparities, which I don't understand because the district judge didn't spell it out. And we've held in United States against Boscarino that that is never a reason for giving a sentence lower than the guideline range. And the guideline range here is life, period. Not more, not less, it's just life. So there are two legal grounds on which this case is a slam dunk reversal. The United States appears to have forfeited both of them. Am I correct?
It would appear that you're correct about 994, Your Honor, and I again apologize. With respect to disparity, it's not clear to me that Judge Clavert was relying entirely on that rationale for going below the guidelines range of life, as you point out.
Did he give any other?
Well, his justification...
There's actually a further problem, which is that our rules require the United States, when it files a cross-appeal, to attach the district court's explanation of the decision under review, which the United States has not done in violation of Rule 30, and that alone would be a ground for summary affirmance without considering any of the arguments that are made on the cross-appeal. I'll bet when the Solicitor General authorized this cross-appeal, he did not instruct you to make sure that you could not possibly succeed on it.
Would Your Honor like me to proceed with the arguments that I've outlined in my brief?
Might as well. Although it's not clear that we'll reach any of them.
Appreciating that, Your Honor, I am confining myself to the arguments to which I've apparently limited myself. I would like to point out that if Mother Teresa were similarly situated to this defendant, in other words, if she had a prior felony drug conviction and had been convicted of dealing these amounts of drugs, you would expect her to be sentenced at the very bottom of what's possible to do, which is, of course, the statutory minimum, at least as articulated in our brief. Mr. Hewlett, of course, is no Mother Teresa. He used a firearm in the course of his drug trafficking. He was an organizer and leader of this conspiracy over many years. He exploited juveniles to shield himself from criminal liability, and he lied during his suppression hearing.
Why, then, did the United States recommend a sentence of 30 years imprisonment, a sentence that, so far as I can find, given 994H, was itself illegal? That was the prosecutor's recommendation. Why was the government recommending an illegally low sentence for this scoundrel, as you now describe him?
A sentence of 30 years, Your Honor, for a 33-year-old man is substantially closer to life, I would point out, than a sentence of 20 years. And I honestly don't know the strategic reasons that the attorney decided to recommend that sentence.
Are there strategic reasons for disregarding acts of Congress?
Well, Your Honor, we've been over that ground before, and I think you were asking why did we recommend 30 within the parameters of what I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
The ostensible reason for doing so was the Assistant U.S. Attorney's feeling that based on Mr. Hewlett's intelligence and his potential to give back to the community, that was a severe enough punishment.
Normally, we think that smart criminals are more dangerous than dumb ones and therefore need higher sentences, not lower ones.
Your Honor, I've heard that argued both ways, to be perfectly candid with you. I will rest on the government's brief at this point unless the panel has further questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ms. Trimmer, you're in a position to respond to the cross-appeal.
Thank you, Your Honors. It would be our position that the government did waive the 994H argument below as well. It would also be our position that the district court did not rely solely on disparity in sentence in granting what we would assert is only a four-level downward departure based on the government's own...
I don't know what people are talking about departures. There are no such thing as departures after Booker. They are just sentences. They may be reasonable or not. They may be in compliance with the statute or not. But there aren't any departures. Departures make sense only when the guidelines are mandatory.
And the guidelines are no longer mandatory, Your Honor.
But 994H still is.
However,
I guess we're past the point that's been forfeited.
Yes, it has, Your Honor. What I would assert is Judge Clavert took into consideration what Attorney Pepper had to say, and that was post-Booker, look at this individual as an individual and don't look at him as a number. And in doing so, he did not just look at the disparity. He looked at, when he said his youth, he meant his time youth, in youth. He was born to a mother who was 13. He had no relationship with his father. He took all that into consideration, and what he did was he sentenced Mr. Hewlett as a human being as opposed to a number. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Trimmer. Anything further, Mr. Hunt?
I by no means was conceding that the government had proved a conspiracy or that Lavelle Hewlett and Gary were members of that conspiracy. I just think that this trial was so confusing and the variance was so great that I know the standard is whether a rational jury could reach the conclusion, but I just don't think that this jury reached the right conclusion because introducing that Missouri evidence, not tying up any nexus whatsoever, even introducing evidence of driver's licenses obtained in Ohio, resulted in a trial that was anything but fair. That Missouri incident wasn't even rising to the level of a conspiracy. Possibly a state court possession with intent to deliver, but that was about it. As to the jury instruction, when the jury wanted guidance, as Justice Evans pointed out, simpler was better. The case law says do not mislead them. The case law, Supreme Court case law, Rogers says let counsel make his record. And that's what I tried to do, is make a record to just include language, if they were going to answer, that said guilty or not guilty. Just sending in the word guilt, I think, confused, misled, and in effect violated the defendant's right to due process and a fair trial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Hunt, Ms. Trimmer, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.